Sunstone Foundation presents Testimony of a Liberal, the Autobiography of Elbert B. Thomas. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Welcome you to this session. Is this mic picking me up?
Yes.
Okay, fine. By way of introduction, we will first hear from Richard Sherlock, and he is a professor of philosophy at Utah State University. He's also an assistant director of the Institute of Political Economy at USU, and he also serves as a member of the Sunstone National Advisory Board. I'm sure you've seen many of his articles appear over the years in Sunstone and Dialogue both. He will be presenting a paper entitled Testimony of a Liberal, the Autobiography of Elbert B. Thomas. He tells me that he'll need approximately 30 minutes. After John has made, or Richard has made his presentation, we'll then hear from John Sillitoe. John is an archivist and an assistant professor of libraries at Weber State College. He is a former editor of Sunstone and Sunstone Review. His book, Letters from Exile, The Correspondence of Agnes and Martha Hughes Cannon, will be published by Signature Books this fall. He is currently working on a PhD in American history at the University of Utah. His comments will take approximately 10 minutes, and if time does permit, then we'll open it for some questions from all of you. So we'll, without any further ado, turn the time over to Richard Sherlock.
I'm gratified to see all of you out there. I didn't get a chance to this morning because of time to see exactly who we were against in the latest revised schedule, but that's always interesting to see who they stack you up against. Sometimes you might as well not have the panel if you're against somebody else. A couple of years ago we were doing a thing and they had us opposite Alan and John's wife, who were discussing the Hoffman affair. And you can imagine the handful of dedicated souls that we had attending our opposite thing. Fortunately, that was not something I had to write anything for. I was just a commentator. So, but I felt for the person who prepared this thing to present and was placed in that situation. Well, I'm going to talk about something today that I think too few people in Mormonism, a man that too few people now remember or know much about, and I'm going to talk about an event or an episode that is now largely unknown, but which at the time I think was a real breakthrough. And I'm going to talk about some ideas that are expressed in this event that I think are ahead of their time and things that most of us think about, but there's precious little public discourse about. In the fall of 1949, a distinguished group of Americans were invited to give an address in New York City in a series set up by the Institute for Religious and Social Studies, which was part of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. The 13 speakers were a diverse group of prominent Americans: the dean of Harvard Divinity School, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor, the immediate past executive director, the American Friends Service Committee, which is the kind of largest and, I guess, most prominent Quaker organization in the United States, though it's not what you would think of as an official, cannot officially decide for Quakers, because if you understand their ecclesiastical organization, you'll understand that there is no such body that can speak for all Quakers in some sort of official way in which the Vatican can speak for the Catholics or the general authorities can speak for the Mormon Church. Founder of the largest Hebrew girls' schools, both in Jerusalem and New York, Judith Berlin Lieberman, Lithuanian immigrant woman, the president of the Central Conference of American rabbis, which was the principal organ of conservative Judaism in the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's law partner, or former law partner at that time, Basil O'Connor, a man who was the senior executive director of the interracial department of the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA, who sat on the board of Howard University, and so forth. Of the speakers, only one was a politician. And only one was born and raised west of the Mississippi River. 13 prominent Americans, only one was in the political life of the country, and only one was born and raised west of the Mississippi. Senator Elbert D. Thomas of Utah, at the time the senior senator from Utah, and a staunch New Deal Democrat. And in a minute I'll review a little bit of his biography and accomplishments that will let you fully understand that New Deal character. The group assembled in New York were not asked to discourse on the great issues facing America and the world, of which there were many, and on which the insights and expertise of such a distinguished group might have been very profitably sought. I mean, these were experienced men and women with a wide variety of backgrounds and expertise in the world in various occupations, journalism, education, politics, law, other fields, religion. Their expertise might have been profitably sought on the problems facing the post-war world. Rather, these Americans were asked to speak in public about things that, for most of us, are private matters, their personal religious faith. Notice they were not asked to give lengthy discourses on theological issues or to preach to the unconverted why their particular religion is true and why everyone else should belong. Articles, books, and speeches of that sort exist by the thousands. By contrast, these distinguished Americans were asked to talk about their lives, about how their faith was woven into the texture of their lives, how their faith shaped their experience, and how, in turn, their faith was shaped by the diverse experiences of their lives. In short, they were asked to give their spiritual autobiographies, which was, in fact, the subtitle, or part of the title, of the book which was subsequently published, interestingly enough, in the same year that Elbert Thomas died, and I think it was published, from what I can determine, it has a 1953 imprint, but from what I can determine, the book was published after he died in 1953, and 13 Americans, their spiritual autobiographies, by Harper and Brothers in New York. Now, at the time he spoke, Thomas had been in the United States Senate for almost 18 years. He defeated Reed Smoot in 1932. And just an inkling of what he had done during his life gives you an indication of why he might very well have been invited to such a forum. He had been successively a missionary and mission president in pre-war Japan, where he met Sun Yat-sen, the father of Chinese democracy, and, as he says, a young artillery officer in training, Chiang Kai-shek. He returned and taught Latin and Greek at the University of Utah and was then registrar and secretary of the university. In the early 1920s, he attended Berkeley, where he studied Far Eastern politics and history, came back and was a professor at the University of Utah, during which time he wrote what at the time and still is a very excellent academic treatise on early Chinese political thought. And he was enticed to run by colleagues at the university against Smoot in 1932 and against what everybody thought were insurmountable odds. Here was a man who had been in the Senate for almost 30 years and who was a member of the Council of the Twelve. He won. During his time in the Senate, Thomas was active on all sorts of New Deal issues. He was one of the sponsors of the Civilian Conservation Corps. He was the principal author of the first federal aid, direct federal aid to education act, which provided for direct federal money to schools in poor states. He was, later on, he was the principal author of the GI Bill. He was the author of the bill which established the National Science Foundation. He opposed right-to-work legislation, which today in this state, that would get you, you know, defeated in a minute. He fought for the repeal of Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Labor Relations Act. He was successively chairman of the Education and Public Welfare Committee, and later what at the time was called Military Affairs Committee, but it was later, the name was changed to the Armed Services Committee, which is one of the four most important committees in the United States Senate. He was the United States delegate to the International Labor Organization, later one of those organizations that a lot of people thought was suspect and should be on the Attorney General's list, even if it wasn't, which was the United Nations, or organization dealing with labor. He was a United States delegate to the first meeting of the Atlantic Alliance, which was the precursor of NATO. Man of wide and diverse experiences, for sure. And had sponsored and voted for every piece of New Deal legislation that came down the pike. It was a man who believed in something about the power of government to do good. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute because it's woven all the way through his text. Given his national stature and his commitment to a special religious group, it may not seem so odd that Thomas would have been a part of such a series as this. But it was a new experience for Mormonism. Thomas was not an official spokesman, nor was some official statement wanted. Thus, his address was not a doctrinal discourse, as Talmadge's little treatise, or tract, I guess, the philosophy of Mormonism had been that he had given at several universities and other places. And the various speeches that B.H. Roberts gave or was prevented from giving, first at the World Parliament of Religions, associated with the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, or his later giving of a speech at a similar meeting in 1933. Moreover, unlike some of the things that official spokesmen, like Talmadge and particularly like Roberts, were allowed to present, Thomas was specially invited to his role. And not in the sense that, well, everybody's being invited, so you can be invited too. They selected 13 distinguished Americans to talk about their spiritual autobiography. It wasn't like, well, it's the world gathering of all religions and everybody gets to say their little piece. More importantly, the format called for a more personal attempt to address the meaning of one's personal faith in a life of worldly action, and not to discourse about doctrine, and not to try to convert people, and not quote scriptural texts of your own particular faith. In fact, I can find none of the texts in here is there very much scriptural quotation at all from any of these gentlemen. Given his stature and the unique opportunities provided by this forum, Thomas's talk, I think, is deserving of attention for many reasons. I want to focus here not on some of the biographical incidents that he recounts and things. I want to focus here on its exemplifying some things that I think have meaning for today that are of broader importance than just for his biographical information. That is, I want to suggest that this talk represents a way of being Mormon that is infrequently represented in our official publications and in our official or semi-official discourse. And even at the ward level, it's infrequently represented. But this is a way of being religious and being Mormon that needs to be more deeply understood and appreciated. Now, furthermore, and this is my own personal view here, and I could discuss this with you if you want at a later length, if Mormonism is to survive and prosper in the 21st century, I think some of the elements of this way of being religious and being Mormon will need to be more widely appreciated and, in a sense, more widely followed. We will need, I think, more leaders, official or unofficial, with these sorts of sentiments and these aspirations for the good of all mankind. Thomas's address was a rich statement of religious, intellectual, and political liberalism, which once dominated American political, religious, and intellectual life. It's hard now in the age of Reagan and the resurgence of more fundamentalistic faiths to realize that, but there was a large part of our American history, and I'm sure our historian back here would back me up on it, a large part of our history in which this way of being an intellectual, of being religious, and being political was much more widely appreciated than it is today. And it even had an honored place in church discourse. We do not hear this message very frequently today. It is out of favor in a number of quarters. Remember, our last Democratic president did not share these religious sentiments, and he came from a very much more fundamentalistic strain of religion than is represented in this address. It is, I think, a view, however, with its own integrity and its own power, and it is well worth reconsidering today. It deserves to be heard and pondered. The liberal faith of which Thomas's address is so rich a representative was at once a faith in man and God. The human soul was not uncontrollably evil, and human institutions were not inevitably corrupt. Thomas understood full well that there were bad people in the world. There were the Jim Wrights. There were the Ed Meeses. There were the Ayatollahs. But that didn't tell the whole picture. Thomas's own first love, government, was a powerful mechanism for human betterment. It could feed the hungry, give hope to the despairing, as he had seen Roosevelt do in the 30s, clothe the naked, educate the ignorant, and bring about peace between people. These were the very things to which Christianity and Mormonism called its adherents as the highest expression of the religious impulse. And an activist, energetic government might just as well commit its resources to these ends and succeed in these goals as individuals, churches, or voluntary groups. Furthermore, next to Joseph Smith, almost as a 13th apostle for Thomas. I mean, I really think that the most thinking Mormons have somebody that this, whatever their sentiment might be, this guy ought to be the 13th apostle. Yeah. For some people, it might be Milton Friedman. Some people, it might be Reagan. Some people, it might be Plato. For a lot of people, it was C.S. Lewis. If you know how often C.S. Lewis, a lot of people think C.S. Lewis ought to have been baptized and confirmed and ordained as an apostle. For some of us, it's other figures. For Albert Thomas, the 13th apostle would have been Thomas Jefferson. Thomas revered Jefferson for many reasons, and he was a principal driving force behind the creation of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington. And if you go there and see the engraved quotes from Jefferson around the memorial, he was the one who selected the quotes. But in brief, Jefferson was the quintessential representative, both, I think, historically, and for Thomas in particular, of America's faith in itself, in its ideals, and its people. Ideals that are not just relativistic cultural artifacts, which is a common thread of thinking in a lot of the social sciences and in philosophy today. But these are enduring truths about equality, justice, freedom, and progress. Thomas still believed, with Jefferson, that America was the last best hope of mankind. And unlike Reagan, he believed that an activist American government had a role to play in that. And he would have been clearly moved to see the way in which American ideals have inspired revolutionaries around the world with a belief in political freedom and intellectual independence. Likewise, he virtually held sacred as an article of immense importance, personal faith. He virtually held sacred Jefferson's commitment to the intellectual freedom of everyone to believe and worship as he or she wished. This, too, reflected a faith in each person's ability to find truth and even God on his own. This faith in man and in human institutions underlies much of what Thomas says in this address, especially the way in which American ideals and the Mormon faith are deeply connected. America was a blessed land with a special mission, and Mormonism was the quintessential American gift to the spiritual life of mankind. I want to read a quote. "We like our apartment." He also liked apartment living because he didn't like gardening and yard work. "Man after my own heart. Because a glance out brings to us every day the meaning of America. For there is the dome of the Capitol, under which was worked out for man the first just, classless tax system ever developed by a government of man. We see the Washington Monument representing the character of the man it honors, whose honesty is the best policy, makes Washington as the founder of a nation without a peer. Back of the monument are the Jefferson Memorial appears. In the memorial are words of Jefferson which give to man the dignity of gods. Quote, God created the mind of man free. No man shall be compelled to support any religious ministry, nor to suffer on account of his beliefs. All men have liberty of religious opinion. Their morality is part of their nature." And that's something I'm going to talk about in a minute that was absolutely central in Thomas's way of looking at the world. "Their morality is part of their nature. I know but one code of morality for men, whether acting singly or collectively." End quote. That was from Jefferson. "To the south shines Moroni." This is Thomas now. "Typifying the restored gospel. Moroni to us represents America's religious gift to all men, augmenting and making more clear the eternal truth concerning God and his purposes." Notice the language, augment and make more clear. Not, you know, impose something entirely new. Augment and make more clear. Eternal truth concerning God and his purposes. From the Capitol, Washington, Jefferson, and Moroni, America's great symbols of liberty, has come Albert Thomas, American and Mormon. The unity of Mormonism and American ideals is, I think, a part of a larger unity of all mankind, which Thomas speaks of here with some eloquence. It is the liberal faith in the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of the same God that motivated and shaped his view of the world and of other men and women, their faiths, their fears, and their societies, as well as the possibilities for peace and growth in this world by following the teaching of that one God, a teaching that is present in some fashion in the soul of every man and woman and in the teachings of all the great religious traditions. Thomas really believed that the American ideals, which he thought that the restored gospel gave a boost to, these ideals of peace and freedom and equality and justice, were eternal moral truths that everybody had an awareness of. This comment leads me to a third theme that I want to talk a bit about that pervades this address. A problem that I suspect most of us, particularly those of us who in this room and Mormons who have had experience with a wider world, have wrestled with in private, but on which there is too little, I think, serious reflection in Mormonism. The problem of religious pluralism. Most of us are familiar with pluralism. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we may have friends of other religious communities. As a citizen of the world who had made numerous trips to the Orient, and who, in fact, when he finished his mission tour in Japan, went the other way to come home, and then thus circled the globe, and recounts in here a moving experience of he and his first wife in Jerusalem during that period where they were on the Mount of Olives, and it came back to his mind, the prayer of Orson Hyde. But he was a citizen of the world. So his view of religious pluralism is shaped by a more worldly, a global perspective, I guess we should call it. Thomas was closer to the problem when posed in global terms. The problem of pluralism was, I think, a core problem in Thomas's own spiritual growth. He was a man greatly attuned to the universality of the religious impulse in mankind. He never denied his Mormonism. It was as much a part of him as his baldness or his English ancestry, and I'll talk about his Mormonism in a minute. Nor would he have wanted to. He revered his faith. But he also never forgot the Japanese Hoku poem that he heard from a Japanese master. And it seems from this, I should have cleared this up before I said this, but it seems that he heard this when, as a young man of 10, his mother took him to the International Women's Meetings, who were being held in Chicago at the same time as the World Parliament of Religions and the Columbian Exposition. This little poem that he recounts with some feeling here. To this day, I remember the Hoku poem he quoted. There are many roads that lead to the top of the mountain, but when once the summit is gained, the same moon is seen. Thomas, I think, struggled at some very fundamental level, and it's a struggle that many of us have gone through. And I can speak with some personal conviction on this, having been a student at Harvard Divinity School and having a number of close friends in other religions. I was sitting up all night with a Catholic roommate discussing the great issues of God and man. These people just are not. Yeah, they have their own way to the top of the mountain. And that's just a very personal experience of mine. Utterly basic. His Mormonism was utterly basic to his soul. And his awareness of the richness and power. Thomas, I think, struggled at some... Excuse me, I got my lines mixed up. Thomas, I think, struggled at some very fundamental level with these two commitments or impulses. His Mormonism, which was utterly basic to his being, and his awareness of the richness and power of the truth in the faith of other men. I think he wanted to believe both that other men and women eventually saw the same moon, but that Mormonism provided perhaps a somewhat clearer or somewhat shorter way to the top of the mountain. This, too, was a quintessential liberal view of the religious life of mankind. But it is a much richer view of the religious diversity of mankind than is heard from the typical Mormon pulpit. It is not an us against them attitude, which is, I think, at some level basic in Orthodox Mormonism since the beginning. The mountain. And let me quote you the passage at the end that I think really states this so well. In so rapid a review, I have been unfair to all, including my own belief. I, in no case, belittle. The faith displayed by adherents of all religions is inspiring and invokes appreciative respect in me. But I am left unsatisfied. My own religion, if I view it as something finished, does not satisfy either. But it is only a commencement of a great promised fulfillment. For is there not a need? And if you listen to the way this is phrased and worded, I think you see something here. For is there not a need for a rebirth of the teachings of Jesus? Where in the world today do you find a complete fulfillment of the ideals of the Lord's Prayer and the Sermon on the Mount? When I say that, I do not appreciate the worth of fine religions and splendid religious teachings, but the need of a rebirth is everywhere. To me, the world still lacks what a Jew would call justice, what a Christian would call love, what a Confucianist would call trust, what a Buddhist would call aspiration and a ridding of life's chains, what a Taoist would call a beginning of the understanding of the way, what a Zoroastrian would call that which makes you do for your neighbor what you would do for yourself. There is nothing in all of these systems of religion that could make me feel that mine was bad. Was there ever a people any poorer than my own people were in the beginning? It seems natural for me to say that all that they are today, their religion has made them. As a historian, an economist, and a political scientist, I know there were other factors, especially the factor of America itself, which contributed to what my people have made of themselves. But that doesn't make me unmindful of the fact that my father's life and my mother's life and my own life have been made what they were and are by our religion. I have full faith that my children and my children's children will see as I do, quote, this nation under God, end quote, as the source of mankind's political and spiritual redemption. Notice the way that's worded, what the source of mankind's political and spiritual redemption will be. And the way he says there's this fundamental moral teaching that needs to be reborn, and it's there in all of the great religious traditions, and it needs to have this flowering. The fourth and final theme that I want to draw out of this text is Thomas's way of being Mormon. Thomas records no profound or moving conversion experience. No fiery witness, no road to Damascus or Sons of Mosiah experience. Witnessing in some immediate and direct vocal way truth of Mormonism. Mormonism was, I think, true. But the way he talks about it here is truth because it was an expression, a quintessential expression of truths that were themselves larger than Mormon. Moreover, for him, being Mormon was part of his soul, his very being. It was in his blood, and he couldn't get it out even if he wanted to, which he never did. He was, as he said, American and Mormon. One cannot cease being an American, no matter how far you roam, nor how firmly you renounce your citizenship. And religious commitment, I think, was similar. Now, this is not what is derisively called cultural Mormonism by some. It is that, too, for everyone. Every Mormon, some level, is a cultural Mormon. General authorities are cultural Mormons. They are more than that, but they are also cultural Mormons. But it is also a deeply personal faith, a way of being religious that was much a part of him as his height or weight or eye color. For one as committed to the religious quest as Thomas, Mormonism was a way to God. He couldn't have stopped being Mormon any more than the Pope could stop being Catholic. Any more than Saul Bellow. I don't know whether Saul Bellow has any commitment to Orthodox Judaism or not. But you read a Saul Bellow novel and it is Jewish. And Saul Bellow cannot stop being Jewish. No matter what he says, I'm not Jewish. Well, he thinks like Jewish. But Mormonism for Thomas wasn't a set of doctrinal beliefs that one defended intellectually, dragged out the latest from farms or whatever and said, see, it's true. There really was, you know, iron in the ancient Americas, and you know, they didn't know this, that Joseph Smith, therefore Joseph Smith is a prophet. Or, see, the old John Witzel thing, you know, see, Joseph Smith said all these things, modern science has just found it out. Joseph Smith's got to be a prophet. I've never read anything from Thomas where he played that game. And he doesn't do it here. wasn't a set of doctrinal beliefs that, when defended intellectually or organized systematically in some vast treatise with appropriate quotations from Scripture, it was a personal faith, a way of connecting with God that is so basic as to be assumed and so unassuming as not to require constant proof or debate with others to sustain it. It was the quiet assurance that one had found a way to God. His life, he says, is a life of prayer. He never talks about having reached the goal. He always talks about being on the journey. It was a way to God, a way in which one could reach and appropriate God. But it was a way that didn't require, felt no need to debate with others, to defend itself against others, or even to try to convince others of its superiority, or to convince others of why they should be this way, except as they expressed an interest and would be interested in discussing questions further. It's a way of being Mormon in the world, in a life of worldly action, of respect and even admiration for the faith of other men and for their innate goodness, which I think we hear too little of today. I think this is a way of being faithful to one's Mormonism and to one's experiences in a much wider and more diverse world that needs to be more widely understood and appreciated. And my comments here have simply been directed toward you. You know, this is a very important document, I think, because of Thomas's stature, because of the life of the church, and so forth. But I think it is also a reflection on something that is of much broader application, a way of being Mormon, a way of respecting diversity and tolerance that we hear too little of today and which we need to more deeply understand. And I think there's much here that we can learn from. And with that, I will turn it over to John for some comments.
I was a convert to Mormonism, and for the first couple of years I was in the church, I thought the 13th apostle was Edgar A. Guest. He's the one that I heard. I first encountered Elbert Thomas as a student at this institution in the late 1960s, particularly through my contact with Professor Frank Jonas, whose work on the 1950 Senate campaign between Thomas and Wallace F. Bennett was later published in the book Political Dynamiting. And if you're interested in Elbert Thomas and his career, you might want to take a look at that. We'll talk a little bit more about this in a few minutes. I next met Thomas while I was cataloging the papers of the presidents of the University of Utah during the period that Thomas was the secretary registrar of the school and a professor of political science. The picture that I had of Elbert Thomas as a result of these two encounters was that of a loyal New Deal supporter of Franklin D. Roosevelt, a competent administrator, an inspiring teacher who was clearly a favorite of his students, a person who took them and his teaching seriously. He was clearly a civil libertarian who fought wartime hysteria in both world wars. He mentions in his autobiography his effort, for example, to convince the state legislature not to forbid the teaching of German during World War I, that wasn't a subversive act. I glimpsed a little bit of this civil libertarianism when I was cataloging the papers of John Widsoe, who was president of the University of Utah in the early 20s. At one point during the height of World War I hysteria, he assigned Thomas as secretary registrar to check up on three German women students to see if they were subversives and to see if they were security risks. Well, as a good administrator, Thomas completed the task, but there's a hint in the memo he wrote to John A. Widsoe that he felt the whole thing was probably pretty silly. At one point, he comments that the only suspicious thing about one of these women was her German name, and then goes on to assure the president of the school that she was a loyal person and indeed a product of Salt Lake City's Franklin Elementary School. During World War II, he tried to separate Japanese citizens from the Japanese warlords who were running their government and their military. So he was a civil libertarian. In his interesting presentation today, Richard Sherlock has helped me, and I think all of us, get a better picture of who Albert D. Thomas was, especially in his role as a religious as well as a political liberal. I had the benefit of reading the essay that he is quoted from. It's a good essay. It's one of those essays that probably ought to be reprinted, and you might suggest that to one of the local magazines or a publisher. It really is an interesting essay and deserves a wider audience. Indeed, the picture that emerges of Thomas in this essay and in what Dr. Sherlock has presented to us today is one of, and I use the term from Lowell Bunyan, a practical idealist. Lowell Bunyan used this term to describe Thomas in remarks that he delivered at Thomas's funeral in 1953. In these remarks, Bunyan noted this: realism without idealism is cold, calculating, cynical. Idealism without realism is operating in the clouds. Realistic idealism means effective, courageous, and significant living. He goes on to say that Albert Thomas's international understanding was born of a deep religious conviction and sincere belief in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. I think we've seen this demonstrated in Sherlock's presentation today. Indeed, the picture that emerges of Albert Thomas is, first of all, an internationalist, a strong believer first in the League of Nations, later the United Nations, a supporter of that concept, support for which cost him a political campaign in 1920. He also emerges, particularly from the essay, and Richard didn't quote a lot of this in his remarks, but he did allude to it, that he was a strong believer in the role of the United States as leader of the free world. It struck me as I read his essay that Thomas was probably a Cold War liberal whose views would probably have supported the philosophy that involved the United States in the war in Vietnam had he lived into the 1960s. He was very typical of the political thinking of that period of time. And indeed, that internationalism, that Cold War liberalism, if you will, may well have brought him into conflict with the isolationist views of people like George Albert Smith and J. Reuben Clark in the church hierarchy. Somebody had it in for him, clearly. He was also, as we have seen, a religious liberal, not a radical, but a liberal. He was a devout Mormon who clearly believed that there was much in the teaching of other religions that could help Mormons better understand and appreciate and celebrate their own faith. Indeed, that's the word that I think is the word to use. He believed in celebrating the larger religious tradition that all of us could be a part of if we wished to be so. Clearly, diversity was no threat, but a strength to Albert D. Thomas. Religious tradition was nothing but a strength. He was a social gospeler who believed that religion and government ought to be concerned about the temporal and the spiritual aspects of people's lives. He was also, I think, a skeptic of church bureaucracy, and I personally find that rather healthy. As he said at one point in the essay, religions generally are broad, but religionists often are narrow. Their cocksureness is the egotism of the ignorant. I think in some ways Thomas anticipated the issue of the late 1970s. You may remember it when people argued that when the prophet speaks, the debate is over. There is a healthy skepticism of church bureaucracy, as I say in his writings. He says it's inevitable that when leaders say something, that what leaders say will take upon itself the aspect of prophecy. But prophecy, he said, is no good unless you live up to your responsibility. You yourself must do the thing. It can't be left to God. God helps only when we do our best. In Richard Paul's classic terminology, Albert D. Thomas is clearly a Liahona. Finally, Albert Thomas emerges through Sherlock's paper as someone who was essentially optimistic and positive, not bitter. I think that's important and interesting in light of the 1950 senatorial campaign, when he was labeled by his opponent and supporters of his opponent and others as being soft on communism and as a tool of the communist conspiracy. This is not the time and place for an extended discussion of that political campaign and all of its ramifications. I would refer you to Jonas's book if you're interested. Suffice it to say, Thomas was a victim of political McCarthyism, whose writings, whose views, whose votes, whose affiliation, and indeed even photographs of himself were taken out of context and deliberately misconstrued. It was a bitter campaign in which the church was conspicuously absent in any defense of one who had always been a loyal member of the faith. Thomas had been a popular senator. He had been elected in 1932 in an election that people thought he didn't have a chance in initially. He was reelected rather handily in 1938 and 1944. He'd run against church figures, Franklin S. Harris, the president of BYU in 1938, Adam S. Bennion, who later became an apostle in 1944. But by 1950, the political climate in Utah, as well as the climate across the country, had changed dramatically, and it was tough for a New Dealer, pro-labor internationalist to be elected, especially in the midst of a campaign of distortion. It's an interesting chapter in Utah's political history that I think bears on what we're talking about today. I think there are several lessons to be gained, as for me at least, as a result of my contact again with Albert Thomas after some years away from him. One of the lessons for me is that the diversity of political thought in Mormonism is extremely important, and there needs to be more of it than there is in these days. We do need someone like Albert D. Thomas today at all levels of the church, and it wouldn't hurt to have a few more in the levels of government. I think it's also important, as Dr. Sherlock has said, that Thomas offers us a role model of a way of being Mormon, a way of being a religious pluralist. I think that's an important issue as well, or lesson as well. There's another issue that I think, a larger issue, that's equally important. We hear a lot about the need for alternative voices, both pro and con, on that issue. We heard some last night. We'll hear some more throughout this conference. I agree that there needs to be alternative voices within the church. My own particular view is that there is of the necessity and importance of what I call legitimate dissent within the church. I think what the church really lacks, and I guess we don't totally have the market cornered on this, is the concept of a loyal opposition, that somebody can be both loyal and oppose church policies and church programs and ideas within the larger religious tradition. We don't have a sense that dissent is by its very nature legitimate. A Jeffersonian Democrat like Albert Thomas realized the importance of freedom of speech and inquiry to a democracy. We need to remember that they're important in a church as well. Sherlock has picked, I think, an interesting and important subject. I understand he's working on a biography of Albert D. Thomas. I wish him well and encourage him. I think there are lots of sources to use. I think it would be an important contribution to our understanding of an important 20th century Mormon political and religious figure. And lastly, let me borrow the phrase from Lowell Bennion and leave you with a challenge. Practical idealists of the church unite. You have nothing to lose but your illusions. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Richard for his paper and also John for his comments. We do have a few minutes, and so if you'd like, we can entertain some questions from the audience. I would hasten that we do need to speak in the mic since this is being recorded. So if you do have a question or a comment, I would ask if you would come up and speak into the mic. And I'd rather you do that than I try to reinterpret what you're saying. Any questions, comments from the body? Or do you two want to? Yes.
I'm curious about his evolution. You talked about the poem and the various roads to the top, and yet he later becomes a mission president, and the focus of a mission president is there's only one road to the top, and then later on he comes back then to the same theme again. So there obviously had to be some kinds of evolutions in his thought or in his process. I see that as a real dichotomy, being a mission president and then coming to that philosophy.
In official Mormonism, that may be there may be some real dichotomy there. I think this was a growing realization with him as a young man. You know, he's involved in other activities and he's fired up with zeal, and he always had a commitment. And I don't want you to get the idea he wasn't always faithful and committed. But I think there was over a lifetime's experiences. Remember, this is right near the end of his life. Lifetime's experiences with, you know, having met great religious leaders and talked to them at length over a lifetime's experience, particularly in the Orient, this was a growing realization of that there was some truth in this poem that he couldn't deny. And it, one of the unresolved tensions in his life, and I suspect in many of yours, is a realization, yeah, there's some truth in that little poem, but also, you know, there's truth in the restored gospel. And how you put those together. It was a growing tension, I think. And you are right, the hierarchy was behind all that. I mean, they were behind J. Bracken Lee coming in and taking over from Herbert Ma, and it was Reuben Clark and the people around him, you know, who were, you know, out looking for candidates because he really thought that these people were evil. And just one other comment about a comment that John made about the business of alternate voices and so forth. I have heard within my, and maybe some of you have heard the same sorts of things. I have heard, right, within my own experience within the last year, comments about other religions as being tools of the devil. And the discussion about women holding the priesthood is prime example for a particular individual, neighbor of ours, prime example of the way in which Satan is getting into the church in the last days. You know, those attitudes are out there. You know, a kind of intolerance is out there in average popular Mormonism.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
Did he lose in 50?
Well, I'm sure you're all familiar that we have in the Book of Mormon and 2 Nephi, the end of chapter 28 and beginning of chapter 29, and also in Alma 29 and 8, statements that the Lord speaks to all people. And there are a few qualifications there. I suggest you read it. But on the other hand, there are statements by Brigham Young who says that there are people who will always resist the gospel. I mean, we have a free agency, and I don't see how we can ever tell what people are going to value the truth enough to come into the fullness of the truth. I'm sorry, my mind's blank.
What's the question?
I think that we are, Mormons are, whether they know it or not, pluralists in a sense, up to a point. It's a statement.
Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
Let's see. I don't know quite how to ask this because this has been kind of an ongoing discussion between Richard and me, so I address it to either Sherlock or Silito or maybe Tom Alexander or anybody else. Why? My question is, why don't we find this kind of religious diversity of and the kind of expression that we find? And I mean predominantly. I know we find it here and there, and that we can go scurrying to some obscure volume perhaps and be satisfied. But why predominantly? Does it get? Is it that it gets... stymied in correlation always, so my question is why? Why not?
I'll just make one comment that I made a follow up on what I said earlier. You know, I think Marvin Hill is right in the sense that the very essence of the beginnings of Mormonism was a profound critique of that Jeffersonian celebration of spiritual and religious diversity. I mean, the whole idea was there are all these ministers out there and they're saying different things and I can't figure out which one of them is right. And so the answer becomes not, you know, find your own path and walk your own way to the top of the mountain, but I got to have a rod to hang on to here. I got to have some. Now, the Book of Mormon has a different Leona and I rod, and we're all familiar with that. But I think he's right in the general sense that the general ethos of early Mormonism carrying right through was, look, if you don't hang on to this one iron rod, you're going to fall in the river. And And then through the whole of the 19th century, there was so much animosity that the whole rhetoric of the 19th century was all these other ministers are, you know, tools of Satan coming at the Church of God. And that rhetoric has played a powerful role in shaping Mormon way of thinking. In particular, because of our sociological structures and so forth that I don't understand and wouldn't care to get into. I'm not an expert.
John? Yes. I would just say that I was in the Army once many, many years ago, and I found it was much easier to march in step than out of step. It's much easier and much more comfortable to not go against the grain. It's easier to simply go along with the program. I think that has had an important effect on those alternative voices in my experience. I've often thought that I spent a lot of years in the church waiting for the church to become Unitarian, and it never did, and I think I finally came to peace with that it was never going to become the Unitarian Church, and somehow I was going to have to fit into it in some way. I still do wish there was more of a feeling that dissent, that of a loyal opposition was there. I don't believe it's there. Places like Sunstone encourage it, and that makes me hopeful.
Our time is gone. Again, I'd like to thank Richard and John for their comments. We appreciate your insights, and we stand adjourned. Thank you.